And this took a couple of days to overcome.
I know.
No, but I mean, this one, like you say, about the...
I know. Sure, geography and moral.
Everybody, for a while.
Sure.
But after a while, when you spoke, and we...
Then they'd forgive them.
I heard a lay preacher in Norway, for instance, in a private home one night, because that's what they do. See, the people don't go to church on Sunday morning because the church has nothing to say. But they come to these meetings in the cottages where another lay preacher preaches, you see, and sort of builds up their group ego. This is the thing, you know, that counts so much.
Do you think a man like Stockford had done...
I don't know who he is, but as far as I'm concerned, not Johnny Trumpet. I don't know, one of...
S, to begin with S.
I don't know, the one that I am most fond of amongst the lay preachers of our time was a fellow who started the work amongst the Indians, Navajos, and also began the work down in South America, and John Carlson, yeah, and he was a fine spirit, and he was always in the prayers of our kids. But he himself knew so well this hazard, and never was unaware of it. And how easy it is, it's all right if I, as a preacher, crack the preachers as long as I'm in a parish. But the minute I'm not in a parish, then what I say is ineffectual and devastating both. It's silly to even say it. The only person who can say anything really relevant is the fellows wearing the same shoes, as we say, you know. And this is always true, and that's why that is. But I was going to say what this one layman said in this home. He said... The sin, he says, people say they can take one drink or two drinks. He says, the sin isn't in the first drink or the second drink. The sin is in the drink, you see. Now, this is typical of their heresy. Almost all of them are Manichaean. They believe that creation itself is sinful, you see. Not in you. It isn't your use of it, you see. It's in creation. And this is why if you enjoy it, it's sin. That's the way you tell whether or not it's sin or not, you know. The Iowa lay movement is typically represented by Ray Olson on a Sunday morning. Ray is now president of California Lutheran College. This is in his first call, and he had a rural parish in connection with it, and there was a blizzard. You couldn't get through the roads at all, but it had blown right down the river, so the rivers were clear. So he put on his skates and skated out to this church where he had an afternoon service. And these people, I'll say that, down there in Iowa, the lay movement hasn't separated from the church. It's in it, and they were there, but they were shocked when he came in with his skates over his arm. No. And they said immediately, we have to have a meeting of the Board of Deacons right after the service. So they did. And they were grilling him on this, you know. And finally, one of the men was on his side in it, one of the younger deacons, said, Pastor, you didn't enjoy it, did you? And he said, 18 below, he says, I'm going skating, I'm enjoying it. He says, hardly. He says, I had a service, I came here. Well, then it's okay. We forgive you, Pastor. And this we all know has been, it's been in, see, we are a late church, very definitely, in the Scandinavian traditions, all of them are late churches. And the laymen generally founded our congregations. Norway didn't send missionaries over. No. One of my grandfathers had 37 churches, preaching places that he went to, and he was a layman. And finally they ordained him. And he felt terribly guilty because he'd been ordained without a theological education. He'd only had an eighth grade education over in Norway like they had. But he compensated for it by giving his children a choice of being whatever they wanted to be as long as they married preachers and as long as they became preachers. You know? And that was sort of the feeling. That was old man Hinderly. But this is that many of them were really lay preachers still. And the strength of the church amongst us was the fact that the pastors never worried much what they said. If the congregation didn't like it, they could go out and run a farm. You know, it just, this was this complete independence. That was a strong thing. And I still think it's true that the difference between the European church and the American church is the fact that, by and large, the pastor in America is, first of all, a layman. He's worked his way through. He's done different jobs. He's been with it. He can talk the language of his men. Whereas, by and large, in Europe, the clergy are professional, and they speak a gavel to group, like you say. My language isn't always your language. Doesn't worry me too much. Shouldn't be, or else I'd be you. But we should be able to communicate, you know. We should be able to communicate and understand each other.
I think it's important that a layman not get irritated, complicated terminology, but some professional things. pretty simple, or out there in the bank, just telling people and talking to them, so that's what I mean. And I know, I've known, like Patrick, I know people who tangle up, all these people need a little love, and try to go help out, they ever get diagnosed with OD-ism, mania-ism, free-ism, and everything, the person just keeps getting worse and worse, and so kind of simple layman gets a hold of it, and gives them the kind of help they need. And then in the education profession, you know, just before the Sputnik, it happened to be in a community where the kids couldn't read. They said the education, the educators here from Columbia University, and they studied this problem, and they understand it, and who am I to question it? And so there's a penalty for laymen to get scared, and it's really right, they get scared of this terminology, and he thinks he's got to be educated before he even dares to comment on it.
Now, of necessity, some exactitude does demand a certain amount of technical language in every field. And this is where we respect the professional and his discipline, because this is what he has done. And all respect to every area of life where there is this need. We can laugh about it in some areas, like psychology's kind of desire to be an exact science. For the United States government, when it was a depression, I got a job making out 1,000-word multiple choice word guess in psychology, 1,000 psychological terms. You think that's easy? There weren't three psychologists that were using the terms the same way, really. I mean, this is your problem, you see. Whereas you get into a science where there's measurement involved and mathematics involved, and you get an exactitude, of course, right away. And this is the attempt of theology to have sort of an international language, which we do, largely derived from Latin and Greek, is so that at least we have the same idea that we're talking about at the same time. We had a man here in the God is Dead movement this summer, for example, who made up his terms as he went along and then didn't stay with the terms he made up, which makes it very difficult to carry on an argument. You know, you have a rough time here, see. But I wouldn't want to argue with him in his area. I would have liked to just take him over where he had an article which he gave me, which he was quite fond, in which he was pure and simple a Donatist. Now, a Donatist in our theological language, it means something very specific, and we've had a big fight over it, and it's worthwhile learning from our history. And we as theologians try to learn a little bit from our history, and that's where the professional aspect comes in. Now, in this article, he had said that the Word of God is effective only so long as the man who preaches it has full integrity and identity with it. Now, this is Donatism. It's like a layman said one time about a fellow he was company around, and the story was told amongst the lay movement generally, that, it's amazing that such clean water can come out of such a dirty pipe, you see. You know. Well, the church has once and for all settled on this side of that question, that clean water comes out of dirty pipes and it's good for us all, it does. When we were on our honeymoon, Mary and I, we stopped in the home of a friend whose daughter is still at St. Olaf, has her doctorate now in the area that she's in, and her father was a very ardent layman in the Baptist church. His daughter became a very convinced Lutheran because of law and gospel. And you could see why we were home. We liked him right away. He's a bouncy guy, and we met a lot of people, friends of his, that got killed out in Philippines later. But while we were in his home, another fellow came in. He just got baptized the third time, this time by a real Christian. And this man said, "Praise the Lord, brother." You know, well, if I had to run around and discover who is the true Christian to make sure my baptism took, you know, where would we be at, finally? You know, how would we judge it, you see? And this is the need of some kind of professional discipline, and why we as a church gladly give a lot of money. Now, for instance, this Life campaign ALC had is bogged down, and it just doesn't move anymore. And it bogged down somewhere between 12 and 14 million, the way you count it up, I guess, and they'll be happy to get 10. But if they'd been collecting for the seminary, see, the church would have raised the 20 million for the seminary. What the fellows had to do, everybody went out with, they sort of shut up about the colleges and stressed the seminaries. Because obviously our lay people have a hard time digging out money to pay for a college that they can't afford to send their kids to, you see. But we need the seminaries, you see what I mean? And the argument that they would say even in the college, well, that's where the men are coming to the seminaries. But unfortunately, we have to be honest even there, and statistics even mean something here. And that is every year, the number of fellows coming into the colleges, into the seminaries from the church colleges goes down, the number of fellows coming in from the non-church schools goes up. And this has been true for the last 20 years. So that there's no question about the tendency, you see. which our laymen aren't stupid, and they examine these things, you know. Well, they say, well, how much money do you want to put into the old battleships when maybe the next war is going to be fought with our rockets, you know? And this is jazz. And this is what hurt lights. See, so they were asking. This is back on everybody's mind when this thing goes on. But this kind of thinking is necessary for a terminology. It's essential, and we all know it. I don't know if the seminary, as an institutional place of doing it, is the best way of doing it. The church has had other ways of doing it. I still think if we had the kind of laity that allowed its pastor time to be a student, the best way to train the ministry would be the way the doctors used to. Assign a man, three men to such a one. And that's what a collegium was, see? In the history of the church, this is what a collegium is. Our word college comes out of this. You assign men with an able man, you see. And they learn by doing. They learn from him. But that means he also has to have enough time so he knows his Greek still and is able to be relating them to some of the issues that are involved in the assumptions. And this is where theology means something. This is where these men aren't good. These men are good theologians. They aren't just lay theologians. They are theologians as such. The problem with a lay theologian, he doesn't always examine his assumptions. He will say, everybody knows that, for instance. And then he'll go on. Well, it isn't true. You can. And this will be the tendency too often of a layman is that he doesn't examine what are my presumptions. What do I assume and take for granted as I make this kind of a judgment and so on. These men aren't doing that. And this is what's exciting. And that's why you enjoy these books so much, is because they force you to reflect on yourself. And what are my presumptions, you see? Now, one major presumption in Out of the Silent Planet is what? And we very quickly see this because all of us read this, what was it, Dick Rogers or whoever he was when we were kids, the first one of these science fiction sort of comic strips.
Buck Rogers.
But remember that all of the invading extraplanetary beings that were coming, they were always hostile.
All except Black Barney.
Well, now you read more about 90. There we are. But this general feeling of the assumption that anything that isn't ours will be hostile. And of course, then the assumption is what? What are we?
Perfect.
We're good. So we make the same assumption when it comes to interplanetary thinking that we do when it comes to what? International thinking. I was at the biggest shock for me coming out of a prison camp. And home, it was the biggest shock. I had two things that I noticed especially. The second one, that the women had become more aggressive with the fellows. In my days, the fellows did the chasing. Suddenly the women were going. There weren't so many men. And they got a little overeager. But the biggest shock of all was that we had moved heaven and hell. Really. I was just amazed at it. And it was an assumption everywhere that I couldn't make, and I hadn't been with it. I'd been in a prison camp where we were still carrying around heaven and hell inside of ourselves. But now we had managed to make a geographical location of it, you see. And the shock for our fellows when they hit hell was to see all of a sudden, these people are clean, you know. They maintain their streets. They'd come up out of Italy and France into Germany. It was a psychological shock for many of our fellows to realize that they weren't fighting devils, but men who were quite cleanly and had a lot of fine things, and they should have just stopped for a minute and asked where their parents came from and where Eisenhower himself came from, you know. But we had made the transfer so good, you know. But it's surprising how deft we are in this psychological kind of thing, because our allies can quite quickly be transferred over into the hell side and our enemies get on the heaven side again, which we've managed to do very well since World War II, as we know. And now when you go and see a movie like that one underwater battle, which is a good one between the two submarines, but you notice how the Germans are gentlemen, their officers are fine men. There's a guy named Hitler back there. They all hate him, but this is a dirty business, but we're in a manly way. We've got to do our duty. And you notice that's been the current theme for, I don't know, I haven't seen any movies that aren't that way. I didn't see Longest Day, which I don't suppose was that way, but the rest of them, either that way or else we're all devils fighting. But this ability to be able in ourselves to make distinctions, as the scripture tells us we must, judge the spirit. You'd be surprised in Paul's prayers how many of them, there are very few genuine ones amongst him, that don't have this discernment, and praying for discernment and wisdom and judgment, you know. And this is what he's continually praying for us. Well, this is a lay theology, you see. This is exactly what he's praying for. And this is what we're involved in. And of course, then we are, then we'll have discussions and people who differ. Come ahead. Oh, yes, often. Now, the difference between Howard Hong and I is right there. Howard insisted he wanted to say it as a layman, and he wouldn't become a pastor. So I said I became a pastor to take his place. He would have made a much better one than myself.
Well, that's what I mean.
Oh, yes.
In that field, they may reach out in a
way. This is right. And our seminary used to say that the most effective church organization in America was the Methodist. And the reason why they grew and became so large, and in a sense, the American church, was because they were able to use the layman. They ordained him, of course. They made him a preacher, but he was still a layman. And then they moved him. Every 3 months, they moved him. He couldn't move. I mean, you see, his mind couldn't move, but you could move his body. And then another congregation got the same set of sermons, you see. And then when they had heard him too many times, you know, he made two or three themes, and you got through with those, then you moved him again. But he was effective. They understood him, you know. And he was effective in the sense, like one of their great lay evangelists that used to, you know, preach in the saloons. Some of these guys at Sassback, he'd knock them cold when they came to, and then he'd preach the gospel to them and convert them, you know. And this is some of their very effective evangelism, which oftentimes works. I saw this work in prison camp where we were taking a lot of dirt and filth from one fellow. All the time he stood at the door where we all had to leave the barracks to go out to the toilet. And every morning, just filth. And one morning, Erwin Lerberg, who was our layman, says, "Shut your trap, or I'm going to shut it for you." You know, and really, it was quite a difference after that. So we sort of get sort of this, you always have to have the soft answer, you never answer back. And one of the problems of the preacher generally is this kind of feminine role that we foist on him. He can't fuss about his salary, that isn't good for him. Everybody else can. Everybody else can strike, get mad about it. He can't say, "We'll get along." You know.
I think some of this is a hangover of this feeling of separation from
your country. Sure, sure it is. But it still works with the very thing we're working with, because he's dealing with the sacred, and the rest of us aren't dealing with the sacred. Well, right there is heresy. You see? Right there is heresy. The minute we say this. That's why we'll never have a chapel up here at the village. If we ever had a chapel up here, we would be heretical. You see?
I heard a preacher say that just because I ring your doorbell and you open the door and you see I'm the preacher, you get convicted. Now, why?
Well, that's what we call a big word here. And we use that as an illustration for it. But the word is worthwhile, again. And it's one of the words that we ask everybody here to remember, that you say telephone and television without thinking about their Greek words, so you can learn this one. Eschatological reality.
I know, that's a terrible
word. It's a good one to know. Because eschatological reality. No, it can be done. It's like cracking nuts with your back teeth. And what you've been just talking about is just that. And that's one of the best illustrations for it. This preacher may be the best Joe in town, the most friendly guy you know. In fact, he may not even have any gospel left. He's just become a good guy. And yet there are people that'll say as he comes down the street, "That old crepin." Because the very fact that he is identified with the church makes him a remembrance for that other person of death and judgment.
It was my son.
This will happen. No, but I know. Well, you think of how nice your son is, and they say,
"Oh,
that.
He isn't, but I mean..."
Oh, he is. In a good sense. Oh, all he is. No, but this is the division. And what happens to the preacher happens to us all when we're identified. That's what the theme is of these novels, you see. The minute we're committed, we're identified. Take one of my men who was 54 when he was converted in my first parish. And he came to me, "Should I quit the Elks Club or not?" I said, "Otto, what would you rather do?" He says, "I'd like to get out." I said, "I'm sure you would. Where can you do the most good?" "Well," he says, "there ain't anybody else around if I leave." I said, "No." But he says, they're really hard on me. They're hard on me. They don't need a pastor over at First Lutheran anymore, Otto. They got you, you see." He was now identified. I think that decision cost him his business. He had a very good one. Yeah, it didn't bother him when he even lost his business on it, because he's that committed. But a doctor one night, gambling at the Elks Club, even lost his practice. He gambled his practice and lost that too. And he had a nervous breakdown. He was a Roman Catholic. Otto reached him. He was converted. One of the last things when I left Manitowoc, we had a strike on in the works, as they call it. That's where they built all the submarines during the war. Now they're building deep freezers and these Manitowoc cranes. And the guys were on a strike. The family that owns it is, they live next door to me and did not even say hello, speaking about this eschatological reality. And they shouldn't have said hello. Because they were oppressors of their health, really. This particular doctor got jobs for everybody that was out on strike within a week, and most of them never went back to the old company. But this is what he was doing then for our company. But that's out of Otto's relationship in the Elks Club, you see. So Lehman is in the same situation.
Well, I
said, what were you doing there? Dad, it's a little different than me. I'm not a Sunday school teacher.
Sure. See how it goes all the way through. Why do did these movements begin?
Because in our situation in America, our churches really were lay movements to begin with, you see. They really were. They came over here without pastors, and that's why we honor people like the Preusses so much and so on, because these were from the intelligentsia of Norway who sensed it as a mission to follow these people and who came. But by and large, most of them were like my grandfathers. One grandfather was converted in Chicago, and he managed to go all the way through and get his degrees and stuff after that, because he was about 18 when he was converted. But these fellows came over here. They were lay people. They started these preaching missions, you see, out of their concern. And my other grandfather was a lay preacher in Norway, where he was in industry, actually. But this idea of being a layman involved in the witness was a real thing in Norway that Hans Nielsen Hauge spent 14 years in jail in fighting for, where the laymen were permitted their response to the word in public. And that none of us object to ever. But what is bad is when you have an anti-church movement on the part of the laity. There's an interesting thing. The strongest revival movement right now in the Scandinavians comes from Rita's country. They're the Laustadians. And we've had another one on our crew this year who comes out of that group. And a delightful fellow that's been with us. But we were just talking about them here in America. I enjoy these people very much. I take saunas with them sometimes around the country. They always have Luther and Galatians there. But their heresy is an interesting one. It's the only lay movement I know whose heresy is really in the direction of the church, even while it is anti-clerical. They believe nobody can call himself saved unless someone has laid his hands on their head and declared the forgiveness of sins. But in their case, it must be a layman. It can't be a pastor. But it does mean acceptance, you see, by the group. And so you are subject, you see. Whereas most lay movements tend to veer off in the direction of a radical individualism, you know. Yeah, this is the focal point for most of them, isn't it? And yes.
Is that attitude that you just described a reaction against the Catholic practice of insisting that the priest has to be between you and God?
Yes, it is. It is. And in Europe, where the preacher is a state functionary, you can see how easily this comes to pass. He's paid out of their taxes, and his relationship to them can sometimes be quite casual. Now, for instance, one of our great reporters, can't think of his name right now, you'd know him immediately, I mentioned him, but he asked when he was in Denmark, he said, I love Denmark, I speak to the Danes everywhere, but why is your suicide rate so great? See, it's the highest suicide rate, you know, in Christendom. And it was interesting, the responses that came back were all in the same cluster, because we have a church that doesn't care for us. Now, when a parish is vacant in Norway or in Denmark, it's interesting, they have something to say about who will be their pastor. They're allowed to choose three men, and then that goes up to the agency above, and out of those three, one is taken. They invariably want to get a Schumann's breast. They ache to get a hold of a Siemens pastor. And it's quite interesting. Why? Because the Siemens pastor has learned to deal with men. He's had to go out to them. They don't come to him. He goes out to the ships. He talks to them, and that's when he gets to them. And so he's become a pastor, you see. And this is their real ache. Every time it's open, they want a Siemens pastor, you see. Or they'll even call back a missionary from the foreign field, you see. Because he's learned to be with people and to be with people. Yes, very well.
He was a lay evangelist in Norway, all over Norway, as a student.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, don't get me wrong, but in all respect to the clergy, I think some of this could have started because sitting under the clergy sometimes, we don't get what we want to hear. And so I don't think the clergy even realizes this sometimes. And so they begin to say, what did you get out of that? I didn't get anything out of that. But I also claim that this is because they don't listen.
Yeah.
But I do feel that in some instances, the clergy speaks above the heads of a lot of people. And so they don't get the food that they want for what they believe. And so they begin to want to have separate prayer meetings, or separate Bible studies, or something.
I think all of us could benefit by reading Luther's sermons, because he can make a terrific use of manure for about 20 minutes in one sermon on John 14, for example. Anything goes, you see, if it will illustrate. And we are far too queasy about allowing this. But I think this is true.
Why don't they get down to the William King and say it?
Yeah, I know.
This is what they're looking for.
I know. This is true. And it's true that each time a pastor breaks through for this in a parish, it's a great day for the parish, isn't it? To help me at this, I mean, we need help. All of us do. I had every Saturday night a group like this, but all men. I didn't allow women to come because the men are more free to talk when the women aren't there. And also, they're more likely to get a chance to. But then we would read about four chapters out of the scripture every Saturday night. And I didn't prepare for it anything. I told them, I'm a layman like you are. I can't keep this on cold storage. I'm learning from you. And what you see that you haven't seen before, that you see new tonight, share with us so we can see with your eye. That's all we did. And this for me was tremendous. I'd have to kick them out of the out of my parsonage about 9:15. And then they go downtown, sit there till midnight. So the wives sometimes would get mad and call up, when are you going to let them go? And I said, they left here at 9 o'clock. I'm not keeping track of them since, you know. But Sunday morning for me was then in tune. I was in focus. I was on the target because they had helped me, you see. And I think we need this kind of help. I've always had this in all my parishes. And it's never worried me too much how many were there, and I tell them you don't have to come every Saturday night or anything of the kind, you're not joining anything. But when you want to, here we are, and each Saturday night I'll be here. And it's been a terrific thing for me. My last parish had got to be so huge we couldn't get in. So then when the men said, this is silly, we got Bibles, we got homes, why don't we do this? I said, I've been waiting for it. We got 11 deacons, start off with 11 homes. Well, we had around 40 to 50 every Saturday night in my parsonage. They had 200 the very first night when they went in their own homes. And the very first night they were there, the guy who owned the biggest bar in town was converted. Fell on the Golden Pheasant Bar in Watertown because one of the men who had it in his home had roomed with him when he first came to town. So the natural thing was to invite him to come on in tonight. Be over with me on this thing. And it hit him like this. So this is the fun of it, isn't it? I hated to leave the parish. That was the hardest thing I ever did, was to leave that. And as Lund knows, from the other, I had a tough time not feeling very sorry for myself. That was a tough thing to give up. And even out of this distinction you just made at those two, the pastor who is concerned in the totality of the church knows that if the scriptures always use baptism to lead you to the living Christ. And they always lead you with this because otherwise you're going to be resting on something in yourself, you see? Now the greatest lay sermon I've heard in my life was by Malik of the United Nations on Sunday morning on just this issue, that he was taking the American church through because it makes too much of this activism and not enough of the sacraments. Because that's why he says we're neurotic Christians in America. Because here's where God meets us in his act. And not our response, but his act that makes it, you see. Yeah, well, that's something they... Well, I would say lots of times when they get into that, they don't know what they're talking about either. So this is the same thing.
Furthermore, there's a human potential to emphasize a certain theme, in a certain book. For example, the book of Job. The only thing you ever hear in all the books written on this is a lesson how to endure suffering. It's written in the Courier.
Not in the Courier. You should read the Courier. That's great.
What the professional does. Yeah. I think very often it's a good thing. Some of the greatest advances have been made by science and that kind of stuff, and in literature by people who haven't had any courses. I mean,
no doubt about it.
Shakespeare never took a course in playwriting.
Yeah, yes. Very right.
And it's got a little bit of a lay of the
hands. Yeah.
That's the one.
Yeah.
I
knew the Scottfold twins. I didn't know him. Naturally, but this response to the Word of God that belongs to the whole church and not a professional group in it. That's what we're fighting for, isn't it? That's what Holden Village exists for. That's what we're fussing about. That's why I say that the deepest alienation is not black and white, though at this moment politically it's hot for us. The deepest alienation is male-female. We haven't heard the woman's response to the Word oftentimes. And as a consequence, our response on it has been harsh or brittle or even sentimental in a way that a woman won't. No woman will get that way about the Virgin Mary that men have. You know, it would have been impossible for the Virgin Mary to get her position in the Roman Catholic Church except for an unmarried priesthood who are doing penance for the sins of their mothers by entering the priesthood, most cases. I mean, this is where she got this unnaturalness, you know, this virgin cult. Well, this is part of the absence of the response of the woman. And one of the interesting things at this moment in the revival of the church, take Cardinal Suens of Belgium. You can buy the book in which this is. It's out in the library, and we have copies of it, and we always will, I hope. The speech is from Vatican Council II. But he's just speaking to this point. He has a sassy little ending for it. He said, because at the first session, the women weren't there at all. And he ends up and says, unless I'm badly mistaken, they do make up over half the human race. There ought to be someplace in the church's response. I think that it makes it more complete in the response to the Word of God.
If you hadn't said that, I would have walked out.
Male and female made he them, and the image of God made he them. And this is one of the wonderful things that comes through in these three science fiction novels, incidentally. This is what Barth really rediscovered for our century. It was spoken of in the last century a little. Bonhoeffer had started off with it and then was killed. And so Barth continued this insight and developed it. And it's a wonderful one. In the image of God made he them. You say, I'm made in the image of God. No, the scripture says we are as male and female. You see, this is quite another thing. And Paul says we are all one in Christ Jesus. And that's the overarching thing overall. But now when it came up, just simply footnote to this, that Laverne was telling me about the debate at our church council, because he led it. On whether or not we're going to allow some of these girls who are going to seminary now to actually be ordained. And he says, let's distinguish immediately, he says, between two issues here. One theological and the other sociological. Otherwise, he says, we'll get nowhere. But he says he couldn't get them to do it. They voted the sociological and the theological. Theologically speaking, you haven't got a leg to stand on to keep them from being in the ministry, because the overarching statement of Paul's is we're all one in Christ Jesus. There's no male-female. Sociologically, you've got some good debate. And you could argue. I mean, one way or another here. We'll go to out of the silent planet now with that. Given, I hope, you women a chance to know that you're in it. In this first book, you aren't in it very much. Out of the silent planet is still in the John Buchan tradition. John Buchan is quoted in that hideous strength as what Mark had missed in growing up. And he should have read some of his books, and he might have been a different kind of person. John Buchan later became Lord Tweedsmuir of Canada, and we are all deeply indebted to him, because it's to John Buchan that, according to Robert Kennedy, John Kennedy owes his political conversion. It was in reading John Buchan's autobiography, Pilgrim's Way, which ran as a serial while both Jack Kennedy and I were back in our college days, that particular series in Atlantic Monthly was tremendous, because at that time you'd hardly heard a Christian voice in our society, anyone with any significance. Here was a man speaking of his commitment to Jesus Christ in the area of politics, who had written all these terrific books. The finest adventure books in the English language still are John Buchan's, and they're fun to read. But the women just don't exist, and they're wraiths walking through them. They don't have flesh or blood. And this first book, Out of the Silent Planet, of course, the women aren't there. It's completely asexual. And so you could worry a little about it, like I do about John Buchan a little. And that whole group of Englishmen who've been trained in their boys' schools without their mothers from the age of 8 on up, and for whom, as we all know, that homosexuality has been a real problem in English life. But this comes beautifully out of it and to the fore in that hideous strength, where you do have the fairy who is a homosexual, and you do have Jane and her husband who are living asexual lives, really. And you do have the resolution come when they discover the wonder of sex and God. It's a wonderful novel, just from that point of view, and that hideous strength. So that is not part of this group. And Dorothy Sayers joined in with it very rosily and merrily, and her books are anything but this way, as you know, those who've read any of her. Have you read any of her detective stories? We've got those here, too. You should read one of them for the fun of it this weekend. I would suggest maybe The Nine Tailors is a good one to start with, which has one of the most remarkable ways of killing somebody that ever existed. This is a brand new one, though. How to do it inside of a church with the church bells, which are the nine tailors. Well, these three books we're going to look at today, and The Great Disease, which is separate from them and on a separate theme. But those are the four major novels for adults, fairy stories for adults, as he calls it, hideous strength. And it's in the science fiction world. I wished I had taken time to look around here and pick out just the tape from his last year of his life, really, on these books and what he said about them. But I'm going to let Leo talk a little bit about C.S. Lewis before we start. I think we have time. Something that you'd like to say. You know more about him than I do. He has a letter from him because he wrote to him after Paul's, Robinson's death, and sent what Al wrote about Paul to him, didn't you? Did you do that? And we got a letter back from him.
I'd like to do this Monday morning.
You want to do it Monday morning? Okay. Do it after all through. But very much a human being and open to people. Paul Robbins just went over and visited with him and had tea with him. And this kind of a person who didn't try to stand on his dignity way off somewhere. One should say that he does not, he made his money, I'm sure he must have made some money on these and so on, but where he made his living was as a 17th century literary critic, really. And in the 17th century, he was considered the most competent person in this area in our time in the English language. So in the Cambridge series, which is the definitive series on this, the 17th century literature, he's written this particular volume. So as a scholar, he stands supreme in his field in the English-speaking world. And he has that side of it. And we have a lot of books in this area of him, and we have some here, like Studies in Words, for instance, or Preface to... Dante's not Inferno, but this whole thing, or Paradise Lost, he has that one too, and he's got a lot of things in this area. We'll talk a little bit about that on Monday morning and read what is perhaps most significant for us in our American scene, and something that's very timely still, and that's a critique on this whole method of education and how you teach language, because this is central to his concern. Well, we'll just go to Out of the Silent Planet. Let somebody have some more. I'll speak a little bit, first of all, on the literary background. I mentioned John Buchan. And if you haven't read his particular adventure stories, you have a treat in store for you. They're fun. Prester John, and oh, there's a whole bunch of them. I gave the whole series to somebody who's very dear to me, and he loved them all. And you would enjoy them yourself. You can buy those, too, and still obtain them here and there. B-U-C-H-A-N. Son of a Scottish Presbyterian preacher who had bleeding ulcers, was not permitted in the army in World War I, and his ulcers were worse because he wasn't where the fighting was. And finally, somebody suggested him, well, why don't you write some books to entertain the men in the trenches, see, so you could feel he was with it. And so these were written, actually, for the fellows in the war, and they are wonderful novels. One that he wrote after he came to Canada as Governor General of Canada, he is Mountain Meadow. and this is a specifically Christian novel. Another one is Charles Morgan, who also writes some very significant spiritual novels, in the right sense of spiritual. It's a man's quest for peace, and again, within the Christian tradition. And The Fountain is a thrilling novel, well written on this whole meaning of an invincible morale, and man's need of an invincible morale, what faith means. And there are others writing who are not directly connected with this circle. This is why I want to mention them. But this particular circle, because it gathered together this rather unique collection of men, has a body of literature that fills that whole post of the wall, if we had it all. It's been an exciting kind of event in our English-speaking world, one for which our Christian brethren in the other countries of Europe envy us a great deal. They're well aware of this, and of course it gives us a leverage in our society. This does for us what the argument for the Christian college in my day was. My father-in-law and Dr. Bow used to always argue with me, because I was never, and I still am not, sold on the Christian college. I don't think you can use the word Christian with a church-related college. I think it's a difficult thing to pull off and eventually impossible. It has some of the same things against it that Holden Village does if you take it simply as a place apart. I mean, if that's what you're thinking of it as. Well, but they were arguing also for it creates a sounding board. It allows us some leverage in our society by the fact that these people from our Christian colleges go out with some knowledge of this and background. Well, that's what this whole literature has done. It's created a sounding board for us. It's impossible to be with people who read at all, know anything at all about the English language at this time, from little kids on up. I was just in a bookstore looking at something, and I was just mentioning to a woman who was looking for some books with her son, who was about 11, and I mentioned a couple of them. Oh, he's read all of those. He's 11 years old. He's already read them all. He loves them, you see. Well, think what this must mean for people who are not in the church or in churches where there's very little of Christian education. Just simply for a boy of 11 to have gone through these things, excited as he will be about the plot, but all the time sucking into his very being the sasses and saps and juices of our civilization. I mean, he's actually realizing what it's about, you see. And this is what's fascinating about them. As they get through this, and they are right now, you can't go to any paperback any place and not find representation of this literature on the shelves. And this is what's so much fun about it. And they don't need naked women in the covers to sell them, you know. Science fiction is sort of a going thing with many, many people, and particularly, I think, a lot of growing boys who love these books. This first book introduces the figure, Ransom, who stays through all three of the books. Each book is independent of the other, can be read by itself, but when you do read The Hideous Strength, there are some references that would be difficult for you to know if you hadn't in mind something of Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra. Certainly it's best to read them, and I think read them in order. Out of the Silent Planet reads the most easily of the three. It just carries you through. The plot is simple, and it gets to you. It begins with a kidnapping. A kidnapping by two scholars of another scholar. And and he gets into this simply because he's involved in a human situation. He's wanting to help somebody who is in a situation of grief because her boy hasn't come home yet from the place where he works, and would you walk over there and find out why? As he's walking on a country hike, and so he gets involved in this, and they have misunderstood on a previous trip to Mars that they've made with this ship by the means of the Western rays. And remember, this is written before our spaceships got going, but it's kind of fun. And some of the things it tells about her are quite real with regard to the kind of problems the men have in the space travel today. But as he's involved in rescuing this fellow from the grip of these two men for whom he is being an experiment, they're experimenting on him to take him to Mars to use him as a kind of hostage. They think that he's been demanded by these particular Sorns, a certain kind of creature on Mars, in order for what they do with him, experimental on him perhaps, use him as a living sacrifice as if there's some lower order of savages, which is the way they tend to deal with them. Because anything that's different from me must be inferior to me, sort of thing. And this is the kind of assumption that these two scientists have been making in their first trip to Mars. Well, they manage instead to pick up a man like Ransom, who is a a linguist, he is a philologist, that he deals in the origins of language. And it's a fascinating area of study. Comparative philology is exciting for anyone who gets into it, in this relationship of one language to another. You notice, I was going to mention to everybody, the difficulty Rita has with the language at this moment. It's much easier for a Norwegian or a Swede coming over here to pick up English. A couple of weeks, they're with it. Rita comes from a language which is basically set up differently from ours, and which is the only one of its kind, together with Hungarian and Latvian somewhat. But it's a language without prepositions. It's a language with 14 cases. You see, and it uses case endings. It's a language that is simply built differently from ours entirely. There's no reason why one language has to be like another, you see. And Ransom is ready for this sort of thing. He's ready even to allow for the fact that these animal-like creatures communicate with words that you can understand. And so he has a kind of apperception. So simply because of this fact, the minute you start to get in it, you know a little bit of this, you go with it. And you allow what you have to do to enjoy anything. You allow this particular novel to take you over. And you're taken in by it. So then now you're living in its world. And the minute you start to live in its world, then you'll start to go along with its particular conflict basis. And I'm sure even a man who may be on the opposite side of the argument as he reads one of these novels, he's going to be taken in along with it. It's like Einstein says, I don't like to read the New Testament. It's magnetic. It has a kind of magnetic influence on me that, you know, operates so that I can't resist it with my reason, you see. Well, the minute you come into anything that is authentic, you start to feel this way. And I'm sure all of you who read this, you're on his side. You certainly aren't going to be on divine side anyway, even though there are a lot of divines running around. And it's an interesting thing, he gets the name divine. The fellow who is simply a crook, an intelligent crook, a fellow who simply is looking out for himself. And even in this final book, That Hideous Strength, you're not quite sure whether he's going to get his in or not. He's got Marilyn in the back seat, and he's running over the old Roman road, lickety-split, as you come to the last chapter. I haven't gotten to the last one yet. But he's still around. Now he's a Lord Feverstone. He's made it. He's the kind of fellow for whom our society tends to give. I used to say that it's no problem for anybody in the church to build a career, because everybody else is trying to be meek and a servant. So if you want to bulldoze them and run over them, fine, you know. And this is true, you see, and it's true even in our society to a great extent. If you want something bad enough, you very likely can get it, because there aren't that many that want it that bad. And he wants it, but he wants it at the price of his total corruption. Now, the other man who's with it, Dr. Weston, is quite different. He has possibilities, real ones. There's a real commitment to his science. There's a devotion and dedication beyond himself. And he has a kind of abstraction for all this at this moment still. It's the human race. And he's present on Mars because he's sort of sounding out the land. He's sort of like the spies that went into the promised land, you know, to come back with the news. And that's what he's doing. Maybe this is a place where, in the event of catastrophe on Earth, the race could be transferred, you see. And this is how he sees himself, as sort of a pioneer of this, that he's on a dying planet that doesn't come home to him from his first trip. And that Mars is much older than we are, and that its day is much nearer to being done. But this is one of the interesting little subplots in the book itself. But the chief conflict then is between what these two men want out of these people on Mars and the relationship that becomes Ransom's to them, who is a Christian, who is a believer, and who has an entirely different relationship as a consequence to people. He is open to them. He is willing to listen. He's willing to assume that they might know something he doesn't, just like a Christian parent does with his children quite quickly, and which sometimes non-Christian parents don't. I'm older than you, and I know better. It may not always necessarily hold. They may know something much better about this bit of machinery or whatever the situation is, because kids start to pick up their know-how fast, too, and there's insights that come. Well, this is what he has here. He's listening. He's learning. He learns their language. From something that looks something like a seal, and is a swimming animal, quite interesting. These hross, they love poetry. They couldn't care less about science. They leave that to the Sorns. That's their field. They love poetry, and this is their life. And you come to love them too. And you sort of feel like they're beavers. And I've always thought, well, You know, if they're reincarnation, I'd either like to be a duck or a beaver. I love water, maybe, but you watch these beavers. They're crazy, aren't they? Right on your 10-mile creek, just since last fall, they built all these dams up. They're way up the mountainside finding stuff they like and bringing it down, you know. They play, and over by our cabin, we're on the North Shore. If you sneak up real quietly and lie there for a while, you'll soon see them running up and sliding down a hill. Just to slide down a hill and go into the water. You know, that's sort of fun. And these frosts have got something in common to beaver. But the interesting element in this book that I think is quite fascinating and that really makes you pause is that danger, hazard still exists. That without danger or hazard, it's impossible to think of a human life. And this is what comes in here in these animals that are allowed now and then to raid their territory, and they have a joint hunting expedition on them. And to have been, had your spear in this animal's mouth or some sort of a crocodile creature, it's something. And this you realize, man can't live without venture. He can't live if he's got it tamed. And this is a theme all the way through these books. The problem in the church is taming the Holy Spirit and not letting the Holy Spirit loose. The problem in society is trying to tame the differences. So the eccentrics and so on are all supposed to be made like the rest of us, and we have a conformity that we suffocate under. It's the differences. And you can't read this, I don't think, in our moment, in our society, without relating immediately to this meaning of race, and the Negro, and the Oriental. And you naturally think in this. You bet, Terry, you got these fellows ready to go? Want to go down to Stehekin? Are the men here? They were going to be out here at a quarter of 11. Fine, Terry. There were four in all. Ask them. There are four in all that were going down and coming back. Which means we've talked through coffee. Was there coffee here? That's why. Just help yourself. But these aspects that are built into it are exciting. Now, you've read it, I hope, some of you, and I don't want to do all the talking. I've got a lot of leaves that are turned down in here some places because they're simply sheer beauty. And poetry written in, right into the prose. Some places because the insight is one that you don't want to miss, because there is a theological presupposition that he is putting into novel form here, which occurs quite frequently with it. But as he said in this interview, I mean, say on tape, pardon?
What is that theological presupposition?
Well, one of them is, for instance, the goodness of creation itself. This is constant through the whole thing. The fundamental goodness of creation. And God saw it all and it was good. The other is that our world is a bent world. We're under the bent elbow. And we can't see things the way they are. We are quarantined, you see, in this book. We are a lost world. And in this world, an invasion has been made by God, however. And that invasion has changed the whole history. Perlandra makes much more of this corner. Because here's a new race starting after Jesus Christ. But even that is a corner for them. Their beginning isn't the same as before Jesus Christ. That the cosmic event, not simply the event on earth, is Jesus Christ. Ray Bradbury, incidentally, makes the same point in some of his novels. And I don't know if you've read this one where they're going to take a mission to Mars and they're missionaries with fireworks. It's sort of fun. But that the event of Jesus Christ is central. Our understanding of existence anywhere. And this carries all the way through all of it. Now he changes for literary purposes and so that there isn't any preachiness in this, he gives a new name, Maladil, and to Jesus Christ. And you will note this as you go through these books, he retains this all the way through. I don't think in the mouths of his own heroes Christ occurs as a name, but in the mouths of the enemy, it does. I'm not quite sure of that, but I think this is so. All the way through, he keeps to this literary device so that you never have the feeling of it being preachy. And like he says, he didn't write these books to be preachy. He wrote them for fun. He wrote them to be enjoyed as fun. He wrote them because it was for him an exuberance to do it. And you feel this as you read them. You don't feel like he's even trying to convert you. Though any book's going to represent the man who wrote it, and this represents him. And representing him, it represents the core of the Christian tradition. And this is the fun part about it. You don't feel ever under pressure here, just like you don't at Holden Village, I hope. Like Anita said this morning, somebody criticized the village, we're not spiritual enough. We get this every once in a while, because you're not going to be spiritual unless you drive a man to a corner and beat him on the head, you see. And as I said when I took over this job, I'll never do this here. We're not going to get people up here where they can't run away and then hit them. No. I mean, people can walk out of here the same way they came. It's difficult, but they can. And you can go out through these books the same way you can, but it's still pretty difficult. Things are going to hang on to you. If you've read a book like this, something significant will have happened. Simply because it is delight and delightful. And he's enjoying it and you're enjoying it. And in that very experience, something's going to happen. Now this is, he realizes here something very significant all the way through here. Something he doesn't put into words in any of his novels, but that it is reserved to the foolishness of preaching by which men are to be saved. You're not going to be able to preach with an art form, you see. An art form, when it becomes preachy, is no longer an art form. It's just tedious. The only place where preaching works is where a man is himself identified with it so that he and this message are one. And that's what preaching is, isn't it? Where you get before the people as the witness. And so this does not attempt to do this. This is not evangelistic literature in any sense of the word at all. And as a consequence, people who are quite foreign to the tradition can and have read it, and they do today. But by being foreign to it, they start to get with it, simply because the affirmations and the illusions are there. Which is, I think, part of the excitement of it. The fantasy world in which he leads you into Mars is exciting. His description of Mars, of Malacandra, as it's called. The invasion is twofold. Weston represents the enemy powers. He doesn't know why he's there himself. We're only obeying orders, he said. And in their obeying orders, they have taken long ransom. And so here again you have one of the deep probing things that's scriptural, theological, and your own life, that Satan always gets fooled. He's always tricked. But finally he has to work for you. You see, this comes out even in Bedazzled. It's wonderful the way it ends. The fellow says, oh no, I'll go back, be my own mediocre self, and winner or loser in my own way. That's how it ends. It's a wonderful ending. But this fact that Satan himself gets tricked, this is an ancient theology and should always be part of the cross. He thinks in putting Christ on the cross, he's won, he loses. And he gets fooled by with you in the same way. Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, this is true. But we don't put the pressure on it, you see.
It's a man-to-man deal.
Exactly. Our first thesis, which we tell our faculty, you might be interested in knowing that, our first thing to our faculty, Leo knows, is that that ignorance is not the absence of knowledge. We're not up here dispensing knowledge. Ignorance is not the absence of knowledge. It's the presence of demonic captivity, which only the preaching of Christ can overthrow. And that's why we have only one discipline. We're all in Vespers, you see. But over against this is all these other opportunities to bounce back, to re-echo, you see, and that Christ is the Lord of all truth, all knowledge. We have the whole spectrum here. We have had always in our faculty areas of concern and curiosity in the truth which our colleges don't have. Even, see? We've always had a good geologist here, for example. No.
But if a soul becomes disturbed here, where should she or he go?
We hope that there will always be ministers to Jesus Christ in our midst. And our workers, many of them deal with this. I do, of course. But there are none of us involved in this that haven't been involved. And this is continuously true. This is one reason why we love having, say, somebody like John Nyquist come now to be a worker for us in September. John's retired, but he relates with the young adult in this relationship, you see. Anita, one thing that bothers Rita, I think, in this, is when they were out on the trip right now, walking, hiking, she didn't have enough openness in their evening discussions. Too much horseplay and not enough real sharing, you see. Well, this is where worker to worker works with this, too. But it's the whole community, you see. We usually have chaplains in residence. We don't now, of course. I am that. But in some of the busier parts of the season, we do. Yes, always have laymen, always. Yeah, no, no, we always do, though.
But I would like to go back to that 11-year-old boy.
Yeah. You had read all this? Yes.
No, I haven't.
No, but he had.
I was wondering now, an 11-year-old boy, because I remember my boy. One was an avid reader, the other couldn't take it.
I know.
But if this boy had never come in contact in any way with Christian teaching, and he read these books, would they definitely, his imagination go one way or the other from them?
I think his imagination would definitely be kindled and be receptive, you see. No question about that. I made this particular book required reading for my confirmants, just so you realize there was some fun in all this, you know. You just didn't all have to be Saturday morning where it's just what I tell them. I don't want to be here, you don't want to be here, but here we are. So let's make the best of it, you know.
Here in the Sunday school and in the confirmation class, can't we get away from this old stuff?
Yeah.
And this is what I wondered about, if this was...
Oh, it does do it. I mean, there's no question about it. Once it changes, just the fact that you make this required reading is the first thing confirmants have to go through. When they go through, well, the girls aren't going to get into it as much as the fellows. And usually the girls, it's all on their side, and it's against the fellows. Here, the fellows get a little advantage over against the girls, you know, which doesn't hurt. The girls make up for it pretty quickly. There's no question that they are more spiritually mature at that age and more able to get it than the fellows. This is one of the tragedies of our kind of confirmation system.
May I come in here? I don't belong to you, so I kind of put you might like to be Protestant and Catholic at the council too.
Good.
I'm an observer.
Yeah.
But how can you go to work and take young college students and give them things like this and like Orwell of 1894 and so on without their having a background of philosophical background so that they can evaluate what they're reading. Doggone it all, it scares me.
Yeah, because they have to begin somewhere, don't you? Yeah. I mean, you got to begin somewhere.
Why in the world begin on the roof when you haven't got anything in the basement?
Yeah, there's presumably something has been taught as we go along, however. We all have something, and we are men. This is written to you as a man. And I would say now, one of the brilliant lectures of this summer was on what the lecturer called the liberal democratic tradition. And we had him repeat it several times through the summer so that people would get in on it. Because he was just speaking of the various elements in our society which still claim and hold to this liberal democratic tradition and those which deny it. But the essential thing in this is that I assume that you are a human being with reflective power so you can respond if I am reflecting and using terms in which we can meet. And this is what these books do, you see. And this is what's necessary. But it is true. It's like it's so unfair to have anybody read Immanuel Kant before he's read Immanuel Kant. It's absolutely unfair to have to read a book of Kant's before you've read him. Because there's only one way you can understand Kant, and that's after you've read him, you see. See what I mean? Now, this is true for anybody that's trying to probe deeply into reality. You got to read the whole thing before you can start to read him, you know? This is right. But then after you've gone through it, it isn't. See? Then you can swim in it. But that, and you have to come back and do it again, don't you? And this is my third time for these novels, for instance, and I see things in them as I read them the third time that I certainly didn't the first time. And I see things reading them quickly in a continuity that I didn't see them reading them apart in terms of years, you see, because I read these years apart when I first read them. Now when I sit and read them as I do now in 1 week, you know. There are continuities that I didn't see. This is yeah. Well, and that's why we all get it, isn't it? We get it by getting it. Just like you've gotten yours. You obviously have a background, and you do, I mean.
Of a very heterogeneous kind.
But it's exciting, you see. That's the way Horty works this. He has this kind up here. This is his Eric Hoffer, isn't it? This is his impact on our society right now. That there is such a thing as a man who is responding honestly with his integrity all the way through his life. And he suddenly comes at something, like you were mentioning to me the other day in a very wonderful way. I won't quote you, but I will quote you because it's a wonderful quote, but I'll quote you later. He leaves us noon, so I can quote it later this weekend. But it's your own way of putting it, and it's a fresh way, see. It's a new way. Now, that's what Horty did here. We were sitting right here still eating breakfast here in May because this is our winter facility, and we eat over here. And at breakfast one morning, Horty sits down and says, if we understood this place, we would have spoiled it. Well, it was wonderful. I put it on the front of the calendar for next year.
Was that something I said to you?
No, this is what Horty, but he's the same kind of guy you are, see? Now, he's been doing his own thinking, and gradually these things open up to him. And he's an adult before he comes into the church.
We should tell him who Horty is.
Horty is the fellow who drives the truck out here and does our hair.
And plumbing and...
Plumbing. He's our plumber.
Yeah, Long, thin guy.
He joined us two summers ago as soon as he retired. He came up here and spent the first summer without pay, and has been back each summer since. And now he's going to live through here the whole year. He's a tremendous person.
Bald-headed.
The first summer, for instance, he reached a boy who was out of a very legalistic home and from a very legalistic congregation. I kidded Fry, the last letter I wrote to him just before he died. I'm glad he got that anyway. I said, it's a funny thing that our most radical theologian up here was Missouri Synod, our most legalistic person in LCA, you know, that it doesn't, these things don't work by synods at all. But we had a boy who was from an extremely legalistic home and rebelling against it. And Horty understood him right away, and the two related just like brothers, a boy in his late teens and Horty in his middle 60s. But one of those tremendous things, the way the gospel works. You ask, who do you talk to, see? Well, this boy needed somebody to talk to all summer. He didn't need somebody to talk to one night. He needed somebody to talk to month after month. And now, just before he went into service, I called his folks, and his folks have come a long way. I went back to see his dad to tell me he had to let him stay here that summer. He was staying here only 2-3 weeks to start off with. And his dad could afford to let him come. He's a plumbing contractor in Minneapolis. And I talked to him an hour and a half. Just, how could you do this? Allow this to happen to a boy. You're a man yourself. You know, and then I asked him for $100 when I was through, which I got right away, incidentally. I mean, he realized there was truth in what I was saying, that the boy had been just overly oppressed with legalism. Well, an older person in Christ can help so much here, who is free, who's got the humor of grace, and can help these kids out of it. And without Horty, Rich wouldn't be rich today. But I called him before he went into service, and I said, now do you realize how, for Rich, swearing is a form of prayer? And his mother, who was the most legalistic one, said, I see what you mean now. I said, this is right, and it is. I said, he's this younger generation, and he's going to have an effect in the armed services because he's rich that he'd never had if you'd made him into what you wanted him to be. And this is true. See, and this is what these books allow, this kind of freedom of the Spirit to shape you. And it will be unlike anything else. These sorns, these throsses, and I can't say the names of the fifth threes because it's impossible to say them with three consonants or four consonants in a row. But these are entirely beings. And you notice where the only place where the women dominated was where? And the Flichtrichs, they were the ones who were making the jewelry and stuff. And that's where the women dominate in Mars. So it's this little bit of a sass in that you women can react to. But the delight of it, just simply delight. And that's what you should read it as first of all. Now here's what he's cracking it all the way through. It's on page 27. And since this is the first place where it really comes in the open here, and it's through all his books, and it's his major concern, the scientist is answering here a relationship that Ransom has said. Ransom calls his philosophy of life lunacy, that he's just been relating. And the scientist reacts. All educated opinion, for I do not call classics and history and such trash education, is entirely on my side. Now, this is a kind of educated opinion that has dominated English-speaking society since Darwin because of Huxley and others who write about this fact that what evolution shows is that we each one should squash the weak, that the strong are the ones who have got the right to it because they're strong, and this sort of a thing, you see. A complete reversal of what we call humanism and humane values in the name of evolution. I am glad you raised the point, and I advise you to remember my answer. In the meantime, you will follow me in the next book and have breakfast, so on. But right away, the first time where this raises up, where this diminishing of what we call the humanities, and the humanities are called humanities because in being involved in them, we become humane, you see? That's why, for instance, Scientific American, and it writes up Leo, had a very interesting little thing on him, you know, this crazy fellow that has this renown in the areas of his own scientific research. And he has two passions, Holden Village and theology. For them, this is almost sort of news, you know, that a scientist has a theological passion. but Leo is anything but alone. And the interesting thing in our society is some, you scientists were saying last weekend, Ed was here with a friend of his, Joe, who is a cop, and that it's at these upper levels today in the educational world where the most excitement about Christianity is usually found. And this is one of the things that's been particularly true since the middle 40s of this century. Since World War II, there's been a new mood. And I suppose the atomic bomb helped a little bit in chastening here, that you leave a scientific method alone without any discipline from the humanities, and what you may finally have is a monster, you see. And this is what even we can see now with what has emerged in the atomic bomb. And of course, that's what all of these books are saying in their different way. Now, there's poetry all the way through, and if you don't enjoy words, of course, you're something less than human, because kids all do. And if our educational system has trained it out of you, allow yourself to train it back. And the way it happens is by just doing it again, giving yourself a little time, a little leisure to do it. The Chinese, you know, they just love this feeling of a well-turned phrase. And when Li Po was sent into exile, he had fun writing his little poems like, some people wish when their son is born that he will be intelligent and witty. Not I. I hope that my son will be stupid and ignorant so someday he may grow up and become the prime minister. Well, they got their fun, you see, doing this back again. And they live forever, you know. They live forever. Here I am quoting him here, and this is back in the Sung Dynasty of when was that? Something like 800 years before Christ, you know. Well, this joy in a well-turned phrase, and they have it, and we should have it. And then leisure can never be dull or boring. Then life can always be exciting, because you yourself are endeavoring to make your language a delight and a renewal for the next person. And remember how much our Lord makes of this. He says you're going to be judged for every argon word out of your mouth. Ineffectual word. Idle word. A word that doesn't refresh and delight. Just mouthing the old platitudes is enough for you to stay in hell forever. And you got it coming, you see? Because you bored somebody. And to bore one of God's creatures is getting close to the unforgivable sin. It should be coming out fresh and exciting because it's you. See?
Oh, keep quiet.
And God is... Well, it is. It is. And nobody is the same, so we do interest each other. Because our Lord did. And he says, because you kept my sayings, what? Yeah. Ye will keep your sayings, see? He says, because you've kept what I've said, they'll keep what you've said. And you'll notice me around here as I'm in the village. I'm quoting Leo, I'm quoting Holly Hong, I'm quoting this fellow, that fellow. These sayings remain because they're theirs in a fresh new way. See? Like Holly's last night when he said, this was in college when he said, what this world needs is more old young people and more young old people. Well, that's a good way to put the issue of the generations, isn't it? And I quote it quite often. Or my dear friend Rumsted, who is one of our great pastors, and we went down to see Mary the night when her conversion hit us on the college. And coming up, he says, my, it's really simple but tough, and we always want to make it complicated but easy. Well, it's a good way. Well, now here are just some of his words, and the words really speak. Notice just the way he writes. I'm using here a little bit from 31, and I'm speaking of it as the sauna. Too bad Rita isn't here. I'm giving the sauna. Sort of, oh, she is. All right. This is just like I said, the sauna here. Yeah. Well, here we are on page 31. He's speaking about this trip through space and describing it. Now, we've had other descriptions since of the fellows who've been there. And peculiarly enough, they'll reflect some of this very same sort of an experience. So the imagination could actually anticipate what the actuality discloses. And this isn't the first time in history that this has been so. The adventure was too high, its circumstance too solemn for any emotion save a severe delight. Well, a combination of words like that, a severe delight. This is on the bottom, page 31. But the days, that is the hours spent in the sunward hemisphere of their microcosm, were the best of all. This is just describing their voyage through space now. Often he rose after only a few hours' sleep to return. You know, it's just a few hours' sleep, that's all you need when you get the sauna habit. drawn by an irresistible attraction to the regions of light. He could not cease to wonder at the noon, which always awaited you, however early you went to seek it. There, totally immersed in a bath, you see, of pure ethereal color and of unrelenting though unwounded brightness, stretched his full length, and with eyes half closed in the strange chariot that bore them, faintly quivering through depth after depth of tranquility, far above the reach of night, he felt his body and mind daily rubbed and scoured and filled with new vitality. Well, anyone who's had a sauna would at once think this is like a sauna. Daily rubbed that tranquility. Oh, sure, and there are experiences that we know in our own, but this depth after depth of tranquility. Boy, when you're sound and the heat is getting into your very muscles and sinews, and then somebody gives you a rub down. You're far above all that. Like I say, you can't stay mad at anybody in the sauna. And this is just what he's saying, you see. The depth after depth of tranquility. Some people say you can't stay mad because it reminds you of hell and you get too scared to stay mad, but it really is that relaxing. Well, here's his use of words. Now you'll notice his kind of method comes in the very next paragraph. You get a little of his methodology that follows all the way through these books, which is his reason really in writing them. But Ransom, as time wore on, became aware of another and more spiritual cause for his progressive lightening and exaltation of heart. A nightmare long engendered in the modern mind by the mythology that follows in the wake of science was falling off him. A mythology. There's a scientific method and there's a scientific mythology. The method, he has nothing but good to say here about that as method. The mythology is another thing. And it's the myth that so often takes the captive mind, that science knows that. Science doesn't know anything of the kind. But it's the myth that he's getting. And this myth was what? That this is all empty above us. It's no longer heaven, it's space. Well, one thing all three of his novels reassert is this is a crowded area above us. It's heaven and not empty space, you see. And this is all three of his novels make this point. So once you've got to read him, you're once more living with heaven. You can't help yourself. Heaven once more becomes a reality, as it is for the scripture. He had read of space. At the back of his thinking for years had lurked the dismal fancy of the black, cold vacuity, the utter deadness, which was supposed to separate the worlds. He had not known how much it affected him till now. Now that the very name space seemed a blasphemous libel for this empyrean ocean of radiance in which they swam. Now this is sheer poetry. But it's wonderful at the same time. He had not known how much it affected him till now that the very name space seemed a blasphemous libel for this empyrean ocean of radiance in which they swam. Well, go out here on any night up there by our chalets, and we've been turning off the lights, you can see him. Look up and see the constellations for your Draco. Look at M31 and then watch the Sputniks as they pass each other up here. The three Russians and two Americans one night in 10 minutes, and one American caught up with the other one, and one Russian and one American closed right across up here. We're afraid of a collision for a minute. We thought we'd need a traffic cop up here. But the heavens are alive, you know, even with our hardware we're throwing them. And we think how much more. And then you think about the millions of stars in each of these galaxies, and then the millions of galaxies. And it starts to get to you a little bit of how egocentric we are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, this is what he does for you here. He allows space to get filled again. And then our own knowledge about it. For instance, these rays we're studying now with some of these hardware we've got up here and how much they affect our life. It comes close to me because my father died of leukemia and we're more aware of the effect of one of these rays, I understand, and its effect on leukemia and its possibility and so on. This is in Leo's area. But all these things that affect us, of which we're unaware, we're swimming. He could not call it dead. He felt life pouring into him from it every moment. How indeed should it be otherwise, since out of this ocean the worlds and all their life had come? Oh, this is true. How indeed should it be otherwise, since out of this ocean the worlds and all their life have come? How can it be dead space when it's from this we originate? He had thought it barren. He saw now that it was the womb of worlds, whose blazing and innumerable offspring looked down nightly even upon the earth with so many eyes, and here with how many more? No space was the wrong name. Older thinkers had been wiser. Again, you see this recovery of the knowledge and wisdom of the fathers as part of this whole literature. That other generations have something to say to us. That it isn't just what happened the last 10 years that's important. Older thinkers have been wiser when they named it simply the heavens. The heavens which declared the glory. The happy climes that lie where day never shuts his eye up in the broad fields of the sky. He quoted Milton's words to himself lovingly at this time and often. Well, you see the style. And that's why you can't just skim for the plot. You know, just to do that, you miss it. It is poetry. You do have to do what Bainton said as he dedicated our library, so we put it into the library, read slowly.
We'll go back again and read over.
Go back again and read over. This is right. Read aloud sometimes, because it's fun. Yeah, well, I'll even read 35 a little bit here, because here we get another side of it. Now he begins to see what this new world could be like, and he reads H.G. Wells back into it. And H.G. Wells we've all read, and in his preface here, he apologized to H.G. Wells, he's enjoyed him. But this aspect of sort of anything that's going to be strange is going to be loathsome. Anything that's not ours, that's different, is going to be something that threatens, you see. This is what he is attacking in this book. Really, he's preparing you for cosmic existence. But here he sees here about the Sorns. And the Sorns would be, what would the Sorns be like? He saw an imagination, this is the bottom of 35. He saw an imagination various incompatible monstrosities, bulbous eyes, grinning jaws, horns, fins, mandibles, loathing of insects, loathing of snakes, loathing of things that squashed and squelched. Oh, the creep in the night. See? He's got all this. All played their horrible symphonies over his nerves. But the reality would be worse. It would be an extraterrestrial other, something one had never thought of, never could have thought of. In that moment, Ransom made a decision. He could face death, but not the Sorn. He must escape when they got to Malacandra if there were any possibility. Starvation or even to be chased by Sorns would be rather than being handed over. If escape were impossible, then it must be suicide. Ransom was a pious man. He hoped he would be forgiven. It was no more in his power, he thought, to decide otherwise than to grow a new limb. Without hesitation, he stole back into the galley and secured the sharpest knife. Henceforward, he determined never to be parted from it. Such was the exhaustion produced by care that when he regained his bed, he fell instantly into stupefied and dreamless sleep. Do you think of facing this new in this way? Now she said 40, and I have that number down too. Go ahead, you read it, Rosemary. Well, here they're coming in to the new world. See, they were falling out of heaven into a world. Nothing in all his adventures bit so deeply into Ransom's mind as this. He wondered how he could ever have thought of planets, even of Earth, as islands of life and reality floating in a deadly void. Now, with a certainty which never after deserted him, he saw the planets, the earth, he called them in his thought, as mere holes or gaps in the living heaven. Now, you'll see this in the Great Divorce, where heaven becomes the most solid thing of all. The rivers are so solid you walk on them. This materialism that's in these books, as islands of life and reality floating in a dead void, that they could. Now, they were mere holes or gaps in the living heavens, excluded and rejected wastes of heavy matter and murky air, formed not by addition to, but by subtraction from the surrounding brightness. And yet, he thought, beyond the solar system, the brightness ends. Is that the real void, the real death? Unless, he groped for the idea, unless visible light is also a hole or gap, a mere diminution of something else. Something that is to bright, unchanging heaven as heaven is to the dark, heavy earths. And so as he arrives, he's involved in this philosophical speculation, and that robs him of the terror. You'll be surprised how much philosophical speculation does rob you of terror. We started every Sunday afternoon in our prison camp a theological discussion, and then the scientists got a little discussion. I've been doing this for about 6 months, and they said, "How come?" They got an interest in all these things. We sit around here. They've been coming, listening. We ought to start our own. And that's the first time I heard about the atomic bomb and this possibility. This is where they're telling me this is what come out of the war, and they're telling me about 231 and so on. I learned all that in prison camp. But when you're talking and being, and the fellow taught me that, says, "How can anybody be bored in a prison camp when he's got millions of years of history under his feet?" And old Jim Thompson picked up a stone and says, "Hey, look, you know, think when the sea was over this," and we were looking down, you know, 6,000 feet almost below to where the sea was, 27 miles away. And it's true. For a person starts to use his mind, any place gets exciting. I was afraid that prison camp would be over before I finished Nature, Man, and God. That was the first month when we were a little naive. And I didn't want it to quit because I didn't know if I'd get leisure to get it done elsewhere. So that can happen to you even in a situation of terror. Right now I've told Minnesota that I would appreciate their putting me in prison rather than collecting the 5 years back taxes they claim I owe them while I've been living out here, because I could get some work done then. I can write a book or something. So if you hear I'm in prison, it's because I need to get some time. And also because I don't think they got any right to taxes while I got to live away from my family way out here. So the government goes. They give us time to write. But here we have all these tremendous descriptions throughout that keep you moving, just they alone. He saw nothing but colors, colors that refused to form themselves into things. Moreover, he knew nothing yet well enough to see it. You cannot see things till you know roughly what they are. See, this is the whole idea of knowing. His first impression was of a bright, pale world, a watercolor world out of a child's paint box. A moment later, he recognized that the flat belt of light blue as a sheet of water, or of something like water, which came nearly to his feet. They were on the shore of a lake or river. And now his relationship to this world and difference to the other two comes to the rest of his time. But I sort of feel like we've talked enough. How many of you have never read Out of the Silent Planet yourself? Well, it isn't expensive, although it's gone up 50 cents. Used to be 40. Have we sold out the ones that are here?
Yes.
Well, I don't know if we sold them or just handed them out. Well, this is, you could take this one for that matter. This is one book that you do find all the time on every bookstore. It's one that keeps selling all the time. So it's easy to get a hold of. My only resistance to it is that it used to be 40 cents in a paperback, and now it's gone up to 95. And C.S. Lewis has died. I don't know who's making the extra 50 cents.
Well, you can still get them for about 40 cents from James Spitt.
You can.
In Edinburgh.
Yeah, that's right. You get them for three and six. And 3 and 6 is about 40 cents. You get them 40 cents any place in Europe.
How do you buy the series?
Buy the whole series from, I tell you, Blackwell, he gets from James Spitt in
Edinburgh.
And I get from Blackwell's in Oxford. And they're both about the same. You don't have to send any money. You write to Blackwell's and say the books you want, and they send them to you. And then sometime later, you get a bill for it. And it's sometime later, maybe 6 months, it may be a year. Don't let it worry you. They aren't worried. And you get it, and then you pay for it. You write for whatever you want. Yeah, you write for the whole series. And then you get them much cheaper. They're half. Any book you buy costs much less in England. And incidentally, all books in America practically have a corresponding publication in England. And the difference in a hardcover will be at this hour $3 to $4 on a hardcover book. That's $4.95 in this country now. Yeah, in Europe I suppose it'd be around $1.50.
Don't they have a duty on it?
No. There is no duty ever on anything in the intellectual world with any country. I buy at Blackwell's, he buys at James Thin, whichever one's easier for you to remember. Blackwell's is Oxford, and Jamestown is Edinburgh.
Then when you order, you just well order a lot of them.
Well, order a lot, because they are cheap.
You can give them away.
And you might as well send them $5 while you're sending it as $1.50 or $10. I owe them up to $50, and I send them $50. And this gets them all confused when you send them money in advance, because they're used to everybody owing them, so I quit doing it. So I thought, in all fairness to them, sometimes I ought to be in debt to them, and they really got rattled on that one. What happens when people die? I don't know. They must lose thousands of dollars a year on people dying before they pay off. But I suppose just because it's the biggest bookseller in the world, Blackwell sells, and James Thin is also a large one. I was disappointed in Thin, though, when I got there, whereas I wasn't disappointed in Blackwell when I got there.
Was he kind of disorganized?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, it looks like a secondhand bookstore almost as you look at it all.
Well, and he writes a letter. I mean, you might get a letter from him.
If you personally,
you know,
yeah.
Oh, I'm looking for this, you know.
Yeah. Well, Blackwell does. Blackwell and Stanley's conversion was fun. Blackwell's was written up in New Yorker 2 years ago. Yeah. You should get the article and read it because it was fun.
And the Blackwell had made Cam, too.
Yeah. Well, this may be the same family. I saw some guy in a Rolls Royce in Oxford. And I figured, well, the only guy that could afford it might be Blackwell. But then I found out they manufacture cars in the town and everything else, so others have money. But it's the most interesting children's bookstore in the world. If you ever travel your grandchildren or your kids, don't miss Oxford in the children's bookstore. Everything in it is to their size. And it's a lounge, you know, it's a browsing kind of bookstore. They like to have you browse. And this one is just for children to come in and browse in their own books. And it's got every children's book in the world. And all these children's stories of C.S. Lewis are there, and George MacDonald's and so on. And it's fascinating. The whole thing is built for children. Even the very building is sort of a children's dream of what a children's bookstore ought to be.
And then when you write to them, I mean, be sure you get the Narnia series. They're probably one of the best gifts for children.
Yeah. The Narnia. These are this. They'll send them to you. This is The Lost Battle, Boy and His Horse.
The Horse and His Boy.
Horse and His Boy. The Magician's Nephew, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and Prince Caspian.
Do you specify then whether you want paperback or hardback?
Do you know what I did last fall? I just told them, send everything in paperback that comes out of the Charles Williams Circle. I just wrote them a letter, just like that. That's all I sent to them. And so we got everything in paperback by them. We got W.H. Auden stuff here in paperback, T.S. Eliot's in paperback, everything here in the intimate circle. It was real fun. So we just filled up all through the winter that ledge behind you from there over to the wall was just filled with these books. And they just sent everything in paperback by them. And then what did it cost us? I think around $47 for books that fill that whole thing over there. So that's a lot cheaper.
On page 15, the divine, talking about divine, I think that was one reason for Layman's movement, about the subjects that he talked about. On page
15 in here, out of the Silent Planet?
Yeah, about four lines.
You mean...
About the platitude.
Oh, yeah. He felt for him that sort of distaste we feel for someone whom we admire. Boy, let's see. Divine had learned just half a term earlier than anyone else that kind of humor, which consists in a perpetual parody of the sentimental or idealistic cliches of one's elders. This whole idea of platitudes, cliches, you mean, that come in?
Mm-hmm. He enumerates them.
Yeah.
It sounds like sometimes like sermons.
Yeah, for a few weeks his reference to the dear old place or to playing the game, to the white man's burden and a straight bath that swept everyone. Yeah, this use of platitudes. Then, of course, it's true for us all. I got tired of hearing my phrases come back at me, so I was in a position then to take off 18 months and did. Took the family over to Europe and studied, and figured about time I'd come back and saying something fresh after running around the country and hearing my own talks too often. But doesn't mean I quit saying all of them. But I did flunk any guys in my class that came up with my phrases. I said, the surest way to flunk out of here is to pick up one of mine and hand it in. You should have your own. You know. This is well done in The Hideous Strength, where he mentions this distinction well in there, and how the church as the body of believers, of course, is the most fascinating and exciting thing on earth. But this isn't what confronts us. We see instead this particularity. And, of course, Luther says in a small call articles, I thank God now even a child of six knows what the church is. It's not a building on a corner and so on. Well, I wished it were always true. No, when we think of the church, we use it in this twofold way, of course. But the church that we know and live with and love. And if we don't love this visible church, there's no other church to love, you know, really. This is where the church that is hidden also confronts us. And I say here, and my board and our faculty knows this, that the church is stopping its support of us as an institution, see. And I said, if this means that we operate outside the church like some other institutions do, I'm on a board of a college, Golden Valley, which was once LBI in Minneapolis, and that's outside the church. I would never have taken a call to serve it because I cannot serve a group which is outside the discipline of the organized body. Some way or another, we have to evolve a way where we're under its discipline. Otherwise, my meaning, say, for the parishes in the area would be much less, too, because it's only as I'm under the common discipline that I can still relate and speak and refer and be part of their renewal, which is what we want to be. We don't want to be a place where we gather the disgruntled, in other words.
Yeah.